Okay, time for a new unit, new chapter, obviously. This chapter has to do with stuff that's going on outside of the cell. It's all about cell adhesions and intercellular junctions and extracellular matrix. And most of this chapter focuses on not only animals, but specifically vertebrates. Little bit of information about plants as well. But in this opening slide, we're looking at an epithelium on the top. And epithelial tissue is one of four vertebrate types of tissue. So you're a vertebrate, obviously. You're made up of four types of tissue. What are those four types? Connective tissue is one. Well, epithelial tissue I already mentioned. Bone is connective tissue. It's an example of connective tissue.
So is blood, right?
So is blood, yeah.
And nervous tissue?
Nervous tissue. And what's the fourth? Muscle tissue, correct. We've already talked a little bit about muscle tissue in the previous unit. We'll talk a little bit more about nervous tissue later on. Yeah, go ahead. No, epithelial, connective, nervous, and muscle. Epithelial tissue, by the way, forms a boundary. It forms a lining on surfaces. Now, that surface can be the external or the internal surface of some structure in the body of the animal. But that's what an epithelium does. It forms a lining. And so when we talk about an epithelium, that is a lining. So it's a boundary between two things, basically. And in any given epithelium, like you see in cartoon form in A, there is a polarized structure. Polarized meaning that one side is different from the other. Right, and nothing to do with charge. And so we have what's called the apical region. Apical is the adjective of apex. Now the apical region, or the apical surface, is often called the free surface, because the apical surface is not attached to anything. Now if this is an epithelium that is lining the internal surface of something, then that, whatever that is a hollow organ, right, and has a lumen. The lumen is just the hollow part of any hollow organ. So, for instance, in the digestive tract, whether it's esophagus or stomach or small intestine, whatever, there's a lumen in each of those parts, and there's an epithelium lining that, so the apical surface could also be called the luminal surface because it faces the lumen. On the other hand, the epidermis of the skin is another example of an epithelium. And in that case, the apical surface is the external surface, right? It's what you touch is the apical surface of your epithelium, of your skin's epithelium. Skin is more than just epithelium, but the epidermis is the epithelial part of your skin. In any case, whether it's an inner lining or an outer lining, the apical surface does not attach. It is the so-called free surface. Whereas the other side of that epithelium is attached, namely to a basement membrane. And so we call that part the basolateral surface. Or some books just call it the basal surface, meaning of the base. The base is where it is attached. So that's the fundamental polarity. You have an attached surface and an unattached surface. Now, some epithelia are stratified, which means that they're made up of two or more layers of cells. Some of them are simple. This one is a simple one, meaning just one layer of cells. But the basement membrane, which is extracellular, it's outside of the cells, it includes a connective tissue layer, which actually isn't epithelium at all, but then right against the cells and created by those epithelial cells and secreted from those epithelial cells is a thinner part of the basement membrane called the basal lamina. Lamina is just a word that means layer. So the basal lamina in any given epithelium is the extracellular component that the epithelial cells are directly connected to, making that layer of cells that we call the epithelium. Well, extracellular matrix just refers to basically everything outside of the cells in an animal. But depending on the tissue type, the extracellular matrix can be extensive or hardly there at all. An epithelium has very little extracellular matrix. That basal lamina is extracellular matrix of the epithelium. But other than that, it's pretty much cells packed right next to each other, as you see here. And that's in keeping with the fact that an epithelium forms a lining. Whereas in connective tissues, there is extensive extracellular matrix. Any given vertebrate connective tissue, which there's a lot of variety of in your own body, like some of you said, that includes things like blood, that's a connective tissue, bone is, cartilage is. Anyway, whatever the connective tissue is, there are two components to it, two primary components. There's a cellular component, some sort of cells, and then everything outside of the cells, which collectively is called the extracellular matrix. You can then subdivide that extracellular matrix into two components. The extracellular matrix consists of some sort of protein fibers and what is called the ground substance. So ground substance and fibers together make up extracellular matrix. And there are different kinds of fibers, and there are different kinds of ground substances, and that's largely what makes the different kinds of connective tissue. For instance, in blood, just to give you an example, whole blood is the entire connective tissue. Well, blood has blood cells in it, but it also has what else? Well, I said cells. Besides the cells, what is everything other than the cells? Well, platelets start out as cells, so they're considered formed elements. Plasma. Right. Plasma is the extracellular matrix of the connective tissue that we call blood. Okay? The cells are the cellular component, obviously, and the platelets are included in that. The plasma is the extracellular matrix. Well, if you spin down whole blood, the heaviest things go to the bottom, right? Centrifugium, that gets rid of the platelets and the red blood cells and the white blood cells. So the supernatant would be the plasma. If you then spin that even more vigorously and for longer, then you separate that plasma into its two components, which, like any extracellular matrix, should be fibers and ground substance. The fibers in whole blood are called fibrinogen. But what's left over after you remove that fibrinogen from the plasma? Serum, right. So serum is the ground substance of the extracellular matrix known as plasma in the connective tissue called whole blood. Same is true for any other connective tissue, though. It's just going to be a different type of fibers or a different type of ground substance or a different kind of cells. But all connective tissues have those components. In the connective tissue that we see in B here, there are several connection points shown by these little black lines between the cell itself and the extracellular matrix. So these things we call adhesions, cell adhesions. Whereas there are connection points cartoonized by green in the part A in the epithelium, those are fundamentally different from the cell adhesions in B because their purpose is to hold two cells together. So we call those intercellular junctions. Literally, something that is joining two cells and occurring between the two cells. Okay, let's go on to two and look at some of these major intercellular junctions that we find in animals. Well, we're looking at an epithelium. An epithelia feature the greatest variety of intercellular junctions. Some of these are for holding the cells together. Some of them are for forming seals. All right, so we have what are called tight junctions in epithelia. Tight junctions, first of all of these junctions are made as a collection of proteins. Now, a single junction can contain many different kinds of proteins, and you could easily get bogged down in trying to memorize all the names for these different kinds of proteins. We're not going to do that really so much. But all of these things that we're going to talk about throughout the chapter are mostly proteins, collections of different kinds of proteins. A tight junction is called a tight junction because it's forming a seal between the two cells. Now, an epithelium is a boundary. And certain things can cross boundaries, certain things can't. Tight junctions are there to disallow the passage of certain things through that epithelium. All right? And in order to do that, a tight junction has to be a band, a continuous band all the way around the circumference of this cell. But it's not really about holding the cells together, it's about keeping things from squeezing in between the cells and thereby passing through the epithelium. On the other hand, an adherence junction is similar. It's also a band all the way around the cell. But its job is to hold that cell together with its neighbor, as the name implies. Adherens refers to sticking together. Now, animals in general, I mean, we use the phrase extracellular matrix when we refer to animals, not plants, because animals have a much more extensive extracellular matrix and much more variable extracellular matrix. And this is because of why we're called animals, right? We are animated. We're animate objects. We move around. Now, I'm not talking about just locomotion, which plants don't do, right? They don't move from A to B. Plants do move around. Their bodies move, just not as much as animals. So even if we're not locomoting, we're moving parts of our body with respect to other parts of our body extensively, much more so than a tree, for instance, which can bend as the wind blows and things, but it's not doing this, right? So there needs to be a lot of interaction types between the cells and the immediate surroundings. In plants, the whole body is basically made up of cells, which really technically end at the plasma membranes, but then there are cell walls that animal cells don't feature, right? So the extracellular stuff in a plant is really just the cell wall material between the cells. And we don't call that extracellular matrix, even though it is extracellular. Okay, so tight junctions are about sealing. Adherence junctions are about holding the cells together. Well, there are also what are called desmosomes, which are also about holding cells together. But the big difference is that desmosomes aren't a continuous band all the way around the circumference of the cell. They are just like spot welds. You know what I mean by spot welds? When you weld together two sheets of metal, like when you're forming a fender of a car, it's not welded everywhere. You take two sheets of metal, and every once in a while, here and there, you weld it just at one spot. And that keeps the whole thing, the two sheets from moving with respect to each other. That's what desmosomes do with adjacent cells. So they're a dense collection of proteins just in one spot on the cell. And you can have several on that same cell, but they don't form a continuous band. Hemidesmosomes get their name because they look basically like half a desmosome. Right? The difference is that desmosomes connect two adjacent cells. A hemidesmosome connects a cell to the basement membrane on which that epithelium rests. Gap junctions are also listed here. And that's a pretty descriptive name because gap junctions are systems of little tunnels. It's proteins, once again, that form these various junctions, including gap junctions. But the way the proteins are arranged, it forms little tunnels from one cell to the next. And so gap junctions, just like tight junctions, are not about holding the cells together. Unlike tight junctions, they're not about blocking things from going through the epithelium. Instead, gap junctions are there so that there can be communication between cells. Communication because things that are small enough to go through those tunnels are able to go from one cell to the next. Now, the diameter of these gap junctions is pretty small, so macromolecules are too big. Nucleic acids, proteins, things like that can't get through the gap junctions. But ions and small molecules, sugars, things like that, can get through. Individual nucleotides or individual amino acids are able to get through the gap junctions. We already took a look at a specific kind of gap junction. Where was that? In heart muscle, right? Those gap junctions were found in what structures? No, that was about how the striations are formed by the overlap of actin and myosin filaments. Intercalated discs, correct. Intercalated discs are found where one cardiac myocyte or myofiber or muscle cell butts up against the next one, end to end. And why was it important to have gap junctions at intercalated discs? What is that signal called? An action potential. In other words, intercalated discs, because of their gap junctions, operate as what kind of synapses? Electrical synapses, right. In an electrical synapse, an action potential in one cell travels uninterrupted as an action potential in the next cell. It just continues. That's not the case in a chemical synapse like at the neuromuscular junction, right? Where one action potential, the neuronal action potential, ends, that causes the release of a chemical, which then ultimately results in creation of a new action potential in the postsynaptic cell. Well, the thing that causes those action potentials is flow of ions. So when the action potential gets propagated to the end of the cell, it can just continue into the next cell because there can be direct flow of ions from one cell to the next. And that voltage continues, in other words. All right, let's go to 3 now. This is really just a summary table of what we just talked about. All of the ones listed here as adhesive junctions, tight junctions, and gap junctions, those are all examples of cell-cell or intercellular junctions. Whereas cell ECM attachments, those are not connecting two cells together. Those are connecting a cell to the extracellular matrix somehow. And so those include focal adhesions and hemidesmosomes. We'll look at a close-up of a focal adhesion a little bit later, but we've already talked about those as well, too, when we talked about cell crawling. Remember, focal adhesions were part of that process. Oh, one thing I did want to mention while I was here is what these things are connected to cytoskeletally. Notice that adherens junctions connect to actin microfilaments inside the cell. Desmosomes, on the other hand, connect to intermediate filaments, which are fundamentally different kinds of cytoskeletal elements, as we've talked about. Tight junctions involve actin as well. Gap junctions are made by complexes of proteins called connexins, and we'll look at a picture of that in a minute. Focal adhesions involve actin, whereas hemidesmosomes involve intermediate filaments, just like desmosomes do. So a hemidesmosome really literally is half a desmosome. By the way, there's not just one type of each of these either. There's different types not only from species to species, but within an organism. There's many different kinds of proteins that make up these various kinds of junctions. And so there's a lot of genes devoted to this, in other words. And one's, you know, what we call a tight junction is not exactly the same for every instance of a tight junction. They're made up of different kinds of proteins and so on, and so is true for the rest of these types. Anyway, let's go to 4 now, and this is a close-up of a desmosome. So this is one of these spot welds I was talking about. And if you go down to C, where we're really taking a very close-up look, notice that the extracellular component of this desmosome, which is in the space between the two cells, are collections of proteins called cadherins. Now, cadherins get their name, actually. Obviously, adherin is part of that name. But the C is there, or the CA is there, meaning calcium. And that's because calcium ions allow for the interaction between the cadherins from adjacent cells. This is what actually holds them together. So another one of the important functions of calcium ions. Anyway, the cadherins are found in the intercellular space. But they themselves then are linked to proteins in the membrane for each of the two cells, which are in turn connected to proteins inside each cell, and eventually to cytoskeletal elements. So these plakins and globins, these are linker proteins linking the cadherins outside the cell to intermediate filaments of the cytoskeleton, of course, inside the cell. Now, this is important because if you were to design a desmosome where it's just a collection of membrane proteins that hook together between two cells, that would just rip apart, right? If the two cells were forced to be separate or tried to be separated from each other, the membrane would just tear. That's why it's important to go through the membrane and link to the cytoskeleton inside. So the two cells get pulled apart, their cytoskeletons are going to be what is bearing most of that force. The membrane won't just tear, in other words. All right, so cadherins are important proteins in this process. 5 is a close-up view of a tight junction. Now, consider an epithelium, which is, like I said, forming a boundary. An epithelium is actually a multicellular membrane. There's two senses of the word membrane in biology. You know, when we talk about cellular membranes, those are either plasma membranes or organellar membranes. Those are subcellular structures, smaller than a cell. But an epithelium forms a membrane as well, like your skin is a membrane, right? It's made out of multiple cells. To be less ambiguous, it's better to just call it an epithelium. But an epithelium is something that can be crossed, potentially. It's a boundary. Well, if you are a particle trying to cross an epithelium to get from either the apical side to the basolateral side or the opposite way, to cross through the thickness of the epithelium, in other words, then there are two possible routes you can take. You can take what's called the cellular route or the paracellular route. Now, what does para mean as a prefix?
Besides.
Yes, beside. Like paralegal or paranormal. The paracellular route refers to a particle traveling in the space between the cells. So you get through the membrane by squeezing between two cells that make up that epithelium. And notice by doing that, you never really enter any of the cells. You're just going in the spaces between. The cellular route refers to the particle actually passing through the plasma membrane of a cell, entering that cell, in other words, traveling through its cytosol to the other side, and then exiting the cell again by going through the plasma membrane on the other side. Well, an epithelium, by having a tight junction, can block, for most things, the paracellular route. That's what a tight junction does. It blocks the paracellular route in an epithelium. We can see that right here. This is paracellular transport. Actually, this is not being blocked. This blue line indicates something that is allowed by this epithelium to pass through. Most other things are blocked by the paracellular route, like you see in the red arrow. The reason, by the way, that the paracellular route could be open to certain things is because when you look at the detail very close up in part D, you can see that these green proteins that make up the tight junction involve extracellular loops of proteins. These proteins are called claudins. The red beads on the polypeptides here they indicate charged amino acids in the overall polypeptides. Remember that some amino acids are charged, some aren't. Some are ionic, some are polar. These are charged amino acids. And the way those come together actually form little channels for just certain things. So most things are blocked. It's just like encountering a wall. A few things might be allowed through. By having the tight junctions, therefore, the epithelium is basically saying it's now up to my cells as to what gets through this boundary. In other words, the cellular route is really the only route that most things can take. And the cellular route depends on that particle being able to enter the cell, which in turn depends on what kind of transport proteins are in the membrane of that cell, which is up to the cell. The cell is always adjusting what kind of transport proteins it has. So in other words, an epithelium is its own boss largely because of these tight junctions. That's one thing a tight junction does. But remember, it's a continuous band, like a piece of double-sided tape all the way around one cell and connecting it to the next. Another thing that does, besides sealing off the paracellular route, though, is it keeps membrane-bound proteins in one side of the cell or the other. So the tight junction is a band that basically is between the apical surface and the basolateral surface, right? Any given membrane-bound protein, because of the fluid mosaic model, can move around, right, laterally within the membrane. Well, particularly in epithelia, you want different kinds of proteins to be in the apical region compared to the basolateral region. You don't want them to be able to migrate from the basolateral to the apical or vice versa. So these proteins can move around within the membrane, but then they get blocked by the tight junction itself. So the tight junction keeps a certain batch of proteins in the basolateral surface and a certain other kind of proteins in the apical surface, which makes sense, for instance, at the lining of your small intestine, the organ that's chiefly responsible for absorbing nutrients that have been digested from the food, still outside your body, right? You need a lot of transport proteins in the apical surface to bring these things into the cell. And so the tight junction keeps that collection of proteins at that apical surface. Otherwise, they would migrate to the basolateral surface. Six. Well, here we see a cartoon of experimental way of showing that tight junctions actually are tight. They actually do block the paracellular route. If you use electron microscopy and you use a dye that does not allow passage of electrons through it, which is what electron microscopy uses instead of light. In other words, if it's electron opaque, it blocks the electrons, then it will appear dark in the electron micrograph. So that's what this dye is that they injected on one side of the epithelial cells. They did migrate up the paracellular route, but only until they hit this band of proteins making up the tight junction. They end right here. That's the tight junction right there. All right, now to seven. Well, as you see, we're looking at a gap junction here. Remember I said when we were looking at the table that gap junctions are made of proteins that are called connexins. So connexin with an I refers to a polypeptide. It's a transmembrane polypeptide. But several of these connexins are arranged into one unit called a connexon. So a connexon is multiple polypeptides, but they're the same kind of polypeptide over and over. And this side-to-side arrangement is what forms the hollow core of the connexon. And so that's where you can have, that's why you can have passage of things through it. All right, let's go to eight. Well, here we're looking at, actually, these are all connective tissues. Bone is connective tissue. Cartilage is connective tissue. Connective tissue, of course, is connective tissue. This one that's labeled connective tissue should really be labeled loose connective tissue. It's a type of connective tissue. But all of these have extensive extracellular matrix, like all connective tissues do. The point here is that that extracellular matrix can vary drastically. The most drastic difference in extracellular matrices is between bone, which is solid, and blood, which is liquid, right? The plasma, which is the extracellular matrix of blood, is liquid, whereas the extracellular matrix of bone is hard because it has what's called hydroxyapatite, a mineralized calcium-containing component. The extracellular matrix in cartilage is intermediate. It's not completely solid. It has some springiness to it. And, you know, that's part of why it works for what it does. But the cells in bone and cartilage, they are locked away in what are called lacunae, which means little lagoon. A lacuna is just a space in which the cell resides in that hardish connective tissue. So these are the osteocytes in the bone. Those are individual cells. And in the case of bone, they're surrounded by completely hard stuff through which no diffusion of materials would work, because it's completely hard. And therefore, bone cells need to be connected to each other by tiny projections of themselves, like little arms on an amoeba, only much thinner. So this cell will send out a cell process halfway through a little canal, and this one will send an arm of itself the other halfway, and the two will meet together. So all the cells in the bone are connected to each other, even though they're the main bulk of the cells are far apart from each other. And therefore, well, one of these bone cells will be close to a capillary, a blood vessel, which is where the exchange needs to take place, right? They need to get things from the blood, and they need to dump things into the blood. Well, the one that's nearest to the blood will take things, keep some for itself, and pass them on to the next cell through these little canals. And also the one closest to the blood will receive waste from the other cells through these cell processes and then dump it into the blood. Yeah?
What did you say the lacuna was again?
The what?
The lacuna. What is it?
It's not a structure. It's just a space. If you were to just zap out of existence the cells themselves, the little holes that would be left would be the lacunae. So there are lacunae in cartilage as well, because it's hard stuff, just not completely solid. Although in cartilage, there aren't these cell processes that connect cells. The cells are actually separated from each other. And the extracellular matrix of cartilage, since it's not completely solid, there can be diffusion of materials through that. It's just a lot slower than it would be through liquid, which is exactly why, even though bone is much harder, it heals a lot faster than cartilage. Yeah. The tunnels are called canaliculi.
No, that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah, a canaliculus is one of these tiny canals that connect the two lacunae. Those are just spaces. The main part of the cell resides in the lacuna, and the arm it sends off from itself goes through the canaliculus. Fibroblasts, by the way, shown in C, they're not the only kind of cells that produce collagen fibers, which are the chief kind of fiber in animal extracellular matrix. But they are the main type of cells that do this. And so that's why they're shown in that connective tissue. Well, in 9, we see in table form what I've already told you, that we talk about the extracellular matrix when we're referring to animals. Plants, though, the cell wall, which is extracellular because it's outside of the plasma membrane, takes up all of that space between the cells. And so the cell wall has as its main structural fiber cellulose. The hydrated matrix in which the cellulose resides is mainly made up of hemicelluloses and extensins. Well, in the extracellular matrix of animal cells, there are different kinds of fibers, but the two main ones are collagens and elastins. In fact, there are different kinds of collagen and different kinds of elastins, but those are two major categories. The gel-like hydrated matrix that these fibers reside in to make up the extracellular matrix are made up of proteoglycans in the case of animals. And we'll look at that in a minute. First, though, let's look at collagen, slide 10. So this is the most abundant animal protein. And it's strong stuff. Collagen has high tensile strength, meaning that it can resist being pulled on. Really strong stuff because it's made up like a cable is, as you can see in the cartoon here. Molecularly, a single polypeptide is called an alpha chain. What I mean is that the single kind of polypeptide that makes up overall collagen is an alpha chain. So it has an end-to-end arrangement like any polypeptide, right? That's technically one molecule. But three of those coil together in a triple helix. That triple helix is what we call a collagen molecule, even though really, technically speaking, it's three individual molecules, right? Because each polypeptide is a molecule. But that collagen molecule is one strand of a bundle that we call a fibril. So you first of all, you bundle together three alpha chains to make a collagen molecule. Then you bundle together a bunch of collagen molecules to make a collagen fibril. Then you take a bunch of the collagen fibrils and run them in parallel to make up an overall collagen fiber. So there are hundreds of polypeptides involved in this in a single collagen fiber, which is why it's so strong. But it's impressively strong when you think about how narrow it is and how much force it takes to break it. Well, in 11, we see how this is assembled. Now, the extracellular matrix contains all kinds, and not just proteins, it's chiefly proteins. Water as well, of course. But where does the stuff in the extracellular matrix come from? Where do the proteins, like the collagen, from the cells is the main point. Proteins don't just pop into existence. They need to be manufactured by ribosomes, right? Well, that's happening inside the cell. So the extracellular matrix components are exported or secreted from cells. In the case of collagen, though, the assembly largely takes place outside the cell. These things would be much too big to complete inside the cell and then export. So what's made inside the cell are the individual polypeptides, these alpha chains I was talking about. And still inside the cell, these three copies of this alpha chain will come together to form what's called procollagen, meaning before collagen. It's not yet collagen. The reason it's not collagen, and the reason that it won't become collagen inside the cell is because these polypeptides have amino acids at either end that are disallowing them from interacting with each other. That's what makes it procollagen. It still has these non-sticky amino acids on the ends to keep them just as separate triple helices. Those triple helices then get exported out of the cell. And when they're outside the cell, they encounter another protein that's manufactured by the cell and exported called procollagen peptidase, which, of course, is an enzyme, right? So procollagen peptidase is a protein acting as an enzyme outside the cell that will clip the amino acids off the both ends of these triple helices, turning the procollagen into official collagen now. So you have a bunch of these collagen molecules outside the cell, and now that they are collagen and don't have these amino acids on them keeping them from interacting with each other, they will interact with each other, and they will assemble into much longer strands, sometimes with a staggered appearance like you see here, which allows for more bending, sometimes without these spaces in between, which makes them stiffer. There's many kinds of collagen. It's not just one type of collagen. But anyway, they can become enormously long then and very wide as well outside of the cell, simply because they interact chemically automatically once you snip these amino acids off the ends. 12 is a cartoon of an elastin molecule. Well, actually, several elastin molecules. Elastin is a protein as well, but it's a protein that has extensive curling to it, as you see. Each one of these individual curls, though, forms little cross links with neighboring curls. So you have this a lot in what's called elastic cartilage, which is for instance, in the pinna, the external part of your ear, part of your nose is elastic cartilage. Things that have springiness to them can be stretched and then relaxed. Well, the reason they're able to be stretched is because this curling that they have can be undone. If a force is applied, you can straighten the curls out. Since they are cross-linked to each other, they don't just fall apart, though. And assuming that the force doesn't tear them, when that force is removed, they will just automatically recoil back into their curled position. So I think you know why they're called elastin. Let's go to 13 and talk about proteoglycans. Just by looking at the word, proteoglycans include what two things? Protein and sugar, right? Glyc means sugar. Well, a proteoglycan is part protein and part sugar, or part carbohydrate, but the carbohydrate component of a proteoglycan consists of a bunch of different GAGs, as they're called, or GAGs, which is short for glycosaminoglycans. Okay? There are different kinds of glycosaminoglycans, but each glycosaminoglycan is a structural carbohydrate, as opposed to a storage carbohydrate like starch or glycogen. Right? It's there for structural purpose. Each glycosaminoglycan is a long sequence of monomers, but it's a repeating motif. So there are two components to this repeating motif. There is, well, let me just show you that there are, although there are more than this many kinds of GAGs, the three major kinds are chondroitin sulfate, keratin sulfate, and either hyaluronic acid or, in its deprotonated form, hyaluronate. All right, those are the three major kinds. Each of them, though, features two things that just repeat over and over. One of those things, in each case, is either an N-acetylglucosamine, which is what GLC-NAC stands for, N-acetylglucosamine, or N-acetylgalactosamine, which is what GAL-NAC stands for. Okay, you have one or the other as one of the two things in any given glycosaminoglycan. All right. The other thing, besides the N-acetylglucosamine or N-acetylgalactosamine, is either a sugar or a sugar acid. A sugar acid is a sugar that has a carboxyl group. Carboxyl is COOH, right? Well, things that have a carboxyl group are carboxylic acids, so that's why we call it a sugar acid. Anyway, this is the deprotonated form here. Otherwise, there would be an H. So, usually, not always, but usually that sugar acid or acid sugar is abbreviated GLCUA, which is short for either glucuronic acid or glucuronate, depending on whether it's the protonated or deprotonated form, or galactose, which is just a sugar, right? So that's the main difference between the three kinds of glycosaminoglycans, what those two particular things are. But in one, you have what is an amino sugar, right? Whenever you have amine or amino occurring in the word, you know you're talking about nitrogen, right? Well, the acetyl group is COCH3. So right here on all three of these, you have N-acetyl and then either glucosamine or galactosamine. That's the basis for those names. Connected to that is either glucuronic acid or galactose to make up these, just these repeating motifs. And then that is repeated over and over. One of these is end-to-end arranged on the next one. That will make up, you know, when you have a long strand of these two things repeating over and over, that will make up a glycosaminoglycan. That's not a that is not a proteoglycan. That's a component of a proteoglycan. When you have several glycosaminoglycans, each connected to a core protein, that's what makes up a proteoglycan. All right, let's stop.